Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, September 11th, 1998. In the fireside room this morning is Phil and Lola Dean. Session number is 98-5 and is titled Service and the Church. Let's listen in.
This session is on service and the family. And sometimes, the definition of family is controversial. The dictionary describes family as a group of persons consisting of parents and their children. And we think that is, last couple of generation definition, and that we, for our purposes, should redefine that. And we'll describe it as you as parent and children and grandparents and extended family, to include a little broader range. And so what we are going to start out with is taking a closer look at the some of the social elements that focus on the family and what the impact is. Please come in.
There's seats right here. We want to be sardines today. For any of you who got Marion's Matins this morning, come on and be sardines.
We say this isn't church service, so you can use sit in the front row.
If you sit in the back row, you get called on.
I always think you're looking at me then.
You're a pretty handsome guy. We're talking about the family. And we just defined the family as you, your parents, your children, and the extended family. And we're going to now look at the some of the social elements that have a strong bearing on the family and its success. And Lola?
Success or?
Or the reverse.
Or non-success. What this is you. And you may be a couple, you may be a single, you may be whatever. Your immediate family, parents, brothers and sisters, children. Come on up here, John. You can hear.
Well, it's going to be for my wife.
Oh, she's lost. Don't worry. We'll worry about her later. Okay, and then we have extended family.
Look in the gift shop.
She's down there trying to pay her bill. That's an in-joke. We'll have to tell you all about it. We kept telling her she made sure she paid for anything, because it would be very embarrassing for the mother of the director to walk out with something on she hadn't paid for. Okay, so this essentially, this is essentially what we're going to be talking about. I think I told a lot of you earlier that I clipped newspapers, when I'm sure all of you had an older person that used to send you clippings, and you say, oh, please don't send me any more clippings. I now send clippings to the next generation. So it's another one of those inherited traits, but there's so much good stuff that's written. And I save them, and I have files. One says issues, and I went through that one the other day as we were preparing to come up here, and some of the things from 1960s I did throw out because they were a little past it. But this one, actually, I clipped, and it's from the 1980s, and I do have it with me in case anybody wants to contest it. And it was from Phil's magazine, Modern Maturity, which I don't get. The article was entitled, "The American Family Has Always Been Vulnerable to Social and Economic Change." And so what we're going to do right now is we're going to intersperse, we do this back and forth thing so we can argue a little bit, about some things that impact the American family today, and then what some of the factual material is that really is causing, or maybe not causing, some of the problems that do exist. Okay, go ahead.
One of the things is fewer children in the family than 25 years ago.
From the late 1930s to the 1950s, the age of marriage and parenthood dropped dramatically. Divorce rates bottomed out, and I remember in the 1950s. The age rate of marriage and parents were both quite low. Divorce rates bottomed out, and the birth rate, one sociologist noted, approached that of India, which has always been very, very high. Today, for the first time in history, there are more households without children than with children.
Childbearing is occurring at a later age.
And this is something that we've all kind of known this. People are delaying having children. But from 1970 to 1986, which is just 12 years ago, the number of births in women over the age of 30 quadrupled. And I think if we went to 1998, we might find that even quintupled or whatever comes next. The age at which people marry today is much closer to that of the beginning of the century. In the early 1900s, people married late because they couldn't afford to marry early. While the proportion of never marrieds is actually lower. Now, I think that may be a surprise to people. The teenage birth rate was almost as high in 1957 as it is today. But most young men could afford to marry and did. In the early 50s, people could afford to get married early. And if you think back to that time, that's about, let's see, we were married in the mid-50s, I guess it was. And a lot of people in my high school class married immediately, right after their high school. And it was a very common thing. And that has continued to go up and up and up. Okay?
Increase in single-parent homes.
Now this, we feel, is real impact on our families. 1/4 of all children today live in single-parent homes.
Increase in households where both parents are working.
Okay, a majority of all parents, including those with preschool children, work outside the home. Less than 1/4 of contemporary marriages are supported by one wage earner. And I think that if you look at your own children, those of you who have adult children, you can pretty well recognize that. Economics of 1972, from 1972 and 1992, 20 year span, shows some startling differences. In 1972, and I'll just put these down, 1972, the average family had to work 65.4 weeks to earn enough money to cover an annual household for a year. Now, that's more than 52 weeks even then, okay? And that doesn't mean extravagant living. It means the basic living standard. Okay, 1990, it took 82.2 weeks. So you had to have a second income to cover those 30 weeks of the year, just to make even. In 1990, it took 46% more income to buy a median-priced house, 65% more income to buy a Chevy. Whoever calls them Chevys anymore?
Well, this is depressing.
It is. I'm sorry. Life as it is. Volcanoes are more depressing. Because we keep waiting for it to go. 92% more to finance a college education. This is the one that hits us. 201% more for medical care. Since 1972, real wages have fallen for most families. It increasingly requires the work of two to be able to support a family. And because of this, many Americans are experiencing a new kind of poverty. It's harder to take a vacation, harder to find money to go to school, harder to find time for the kids with both parents working, if it's possible to have them in the first place. And a lot of people are really delaying that because they really don't feel they can afford to have children. Okay?
Decreased proximity to extended family.
The number of retirement-aged people who move from one state to another increased 63% from 1982 to 1992. Now, many of these people moved from Minnesota to Arizona, and I can understand that in the winter, but a lot of them did move to warmer, or either to a warmer climate or to a gentler climate anyway.
Or to the San Juan Islands.
Yeah.
Families move more frequently.
Wait, I want to face you when I talk, so, okay. Many corporations move employees. And I think those of you who have been with big corporations or still have people who are working or have people who are working with big corporations or have children who work with big corporations, you know that the predictable job ladders of the 50s and 60s, you start with a company, you're going to be with that company your entire working life. Those legs of that ladder have been sawed off. Companies are portable, workers are throwaway. And I'd like to get back into that because I think there's some of you who do work for companies and might want to speak to that issue.
Adults change careers more frequently.
One of the fastest growing industries is in the field of temporary employment. Technology has required retraining of many workers, and the economic change from heavy industry to technology and service industries has displaced many workers. How many of you stayed with the same job your entire working life, those of you who are retired? Yeah.
How many have had two careers? How many have had three careers? Look at that. Four? Anybody for four?
I had four, but I decided that's what I wanted to do.
Well, I just thought that's what I wanted to do, too. Yeah.
But we were the last of the luckiest people in the world. This has always been my thesis. The American wife of the 50s and 60s who had a husband who could provide for her.
No, I wasn't one of those.
You weren't. Okay, I was. I did not have to work. I worked by choice.
No, I didn't.
But it was a whole generation of women who could stay home, most of them, if they wanted to. Being a preacher's wife, that makes it a little harder. We don't pay
our mission pastors, don't.
And then it's interesting too with that, because if you're the child of one of those people, then you think that that's how you should be too. Mm-hmm. And then you end up going, I don't want to work, you don't want to go to work when you got, because you really should be able to stay home.
So you get a little more of that guilt coming down that we put on moms who have to go to work sometime, and that does exist.
Okay, another feature is a decrease in family togetherness time.
Now, we disagree a little bit on this one. Because this
wrong.
Is... I usually am, but I really fight a lot about it. This concept can be very debatable and depends upon the family and the time frame you're comparing it to. And the one I really loved was, in colonial times, mothers were far less involved in caring for their children than the modern working woman, typically delegating a task to servants or older siblings. Children often left home before puberty to work as servants or apprentices, when writing home would sometimes add a postscript asking their father to give my regards to my mother, your wife.
Communication explosion and involvement with that has impact on family.
Okay, there's never been a time in history when such an outside barrage of information has been available. The impact of family members' time being consumed by telephone, television, computers, dilutes the time that families could choose to do things together. Many families rarely have family meals at home. Eating out has become much more prevalent, and family members do not necessarily sit down to eat together. Okay,
we look at our grandchildren, and we had grandchildren all summer long. And they play basketball, and then they come in the house, and some would plunk down in front of the computer and play computer games, and the others would plunk in front of the television. And it was like pulling teeth to keep the TV turned off. To have them, we've got a huge library and a huge library of children's books, to get them to read, to get them to play board games or do anything creative together so that you develop a harmony in play rather than individually plugging in.
How mean did you have to be?
Very.
Pretty. Wait, it was an interesting situation, though, for us, because these children are from Dallas, Texas, and Phoenix, Arizona, and they're not used to playing outside in the summer.
No.
Because of the heat. And so that was an interesting factor to us. No, they finally got this Monopoly game going, and we put them in the great room and closed the doors because we couldn't stand it.
They want the rock music on.
Well, that plus they were fighting so hard. It was...
I saw a plan of this dream house for the family. Of course, the family had two children. And there was a wing for mom and dad, master the suite. And then there was a children's wing. And in the children's wing, each kid had a room with its own television, computer,
telephone,
with its own line.
Yeah.
And that family would never have to meet. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sometimes that's not so bad, you know. Sometimes you would like to just go to your wing and say, I don't know those people over there.
Yeah.
But that's not.
Okay.
That's not family.
Yeah. No, you're right. That's not what we think of as family.
What
are some of the things that you think of that are impacting family here? We could put communication.
Mm. Well, this busyness.
Being so busy in other worlds that you can't get together to do things.
Every kid has got a million activities, and they come home and have to be taken here, and then they get back and you take the next kid here, and then they get back, and then you pick up. Maybe you can get two. You know, we had four kids in three different schools.
Well, there's a real threat of having your children over-organized.
Over-organized. I think it can happen. But filled, idle, hands of the devil.
Whatever happened, a hole is to dig.
Yeah.
Anybody remember that?
Yeah.
It's time to redo that little book.
A hole is to dig.
A hole is to dig. Kids should go play in the sandbox and dream. When do we dream our dreams? What are some other things?
I think neighborhood and...
Decreased neighborhood?
Well, just a neighborhood that was more or less dependent on one another. Now everybody seems to be independent. They have no real need for neighbors. Everybody has their own lawnmower or whatever.
Yes.
Okay, what else?
One of the factors that I wonder about, and Noreen and I have talked about, is the fact that it used to be that Sundays were set aside for church and family. Now Sundays, the communities are scheduling soccer games, tournaments, contests, events, and these are the civic groups, that are sponsoring these things, but they're picking Sundays to do these things, and they're starting them early in the morning. If they would even do them in the afternoon, after you had a chance as a family to participate in church and Sunday school and so forth. But these things start at 8 o'clock in the morning, and everybody wants their kids to be involved in these kinds of things. And I kind of wonder, and we have a good friend who's a member of the Kiwanis, and they schedule things on Sunday mornings. Well, why couldn't those be scheduled on Saturday or start at noon on Sunday in the afternoon? So that there would be an opportunity. So I think that has an impact.
Yeah.
I don't know how you'd write that in, but I think that...
Well, the stores used to be closed on Sunday, too.
Yeah, right. We could say family time.
Well, I'm dating myself, but back
no,
then...
No, I agree with you,
yeah. Most stores open on Sunday.
I do really recommend to all of you the chapter on Sabbath in here.
Yeah, I haven't read that far.
Yeah, but it might be one you want to give to your younger families and... Somehow.
But I think that's a factor. I don't know how you'd write it up.
Yeah.
I
put deep family time.
Have you ever been in the mall on Sunday?
Oh,
yeah. Well, if you work all week.
Yeah, that's the only time you can do it.
Clean on Saturday and you shop on Sunday.
Yeah.
Well, on the communications, I found that the computer is what keeps the family together.
Both
we have
ways.
To get a computer in order to be in this loop.
Yeah.
All the kids were writing to send out a family letter. All right, we weren't getting it, so now we've got a...
You have to get email to get in the loop.
Yeah.
I have a little joke. How many of you have jokes on your refrigerator? Well, I've got one on my refrigerator, and there's this very coiffed-looking grandmother sitting at her very executive-type desk, and she says, hi, honey, my granddaughter, did you beep? We have a single parent son who has raised his girls all by himself, and our oldest granddaughter is now 15, and so that's it. I'm the one to whom she beeps, and so I'm there.
We also have a sign on our refrigerator that says, money isn't everything, but it sure helps keep the kids in touch.
Okay, there's one no one has touched on yet, which has come up before. We've done this one other time, and I think it's a real critical one. How about safety? Mm. Our kids live in a very different world than we did. Decreased, I don't know how we say this, income, but you guys know what I mean, right? Okay.
That safety thing is just, when I start thinking about that, it's just almost impossible for me to imagine the difference between my life and my grandchildren.
I know. It's very scary.
And Emily and Maggie up here, and what they're going to meet when they get out there
after
next
5 years.
Year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But
I'm going to go with Maggie. I'm just going to handcuff myself to her.
As we go through the rest of the time, we're going to come back to each of these and see how we can break the negatives on each. There's one more that just came to my mind. Does education concern you? Do you feel the children are the next generations are getting as good an education as we were, all of us were able to get?
Yes, in some ways, no.
In some ways, yes. That's a mixed one, isn't it? Yeah. Let's put it in there because it is an in
it's
factor.
Different.
Yeah.
But it's grammar isn't as good.
I can't write with a darn.
The grammar isn't as good.
I can't write at all.
No.
Okay.
Hello, can I say something?
Sure, George.
If you were a child, you know, a teenager looking at this, you'd say, well, that's the way it is, and it's normal. They don't have the perspective that it is another time. Mm-hmm. So how do you deal with them and telling them, well, this ought to be different? They're saying, well, that's the way it is. It's normal.
We're going to come back to that.
It is normal.
It's different from our parents.
That's right.
Yes, exactly.
That wasn't perfect either.
Right.
Well, we thought we'd focus for a minute on some passages in the Bible that speak to this. And in Timothy, 1 Timothy 5th chapter 8th verse, if anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for his immediate family, he is denied the faith and worse than an unbeliever.
How's that? Go ahead, Phil.
First Timothy 5:8.
Yeah.
And 2 Timothy 1:5. I have been reminded of your sincere faith, which first lived in your grandmother Lois and in your mother Eunice, and I am persuaded now lives in you also. The value of passing on appropriate traditions and appropriate values are about as key element as you can get. In Proverbs 22:6, train a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not turn from it. And I guess that
sometimes
we all develop our value systems, accrue them gradually as we grow, and once they're set, you hope that you have enough grip inside you to maintain them.
Okay, based on the discussion so far, what would you say would be the strongest family memory you have that molded you? And it may have come from a grandparent, a parent, anyone in your family.
strongest
family memory, the strongest memory you have
that had a positive impact on you?
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Well, I think Sunday in my family, Sunday was, it was automatic Sunday school and church. I mean, it was just there. And of course, I was in a small community, and so it was that way for most people.
So keeping the Sabbath, in a sense.
Yeah, really,
we don't have religion up here, do we?
No.
Oh, it's not important.
That's a given, right? I mean, everybody just assumed that.
We don't assume anything.
That's the one you forgot.
And really, separate from religion, I think, is a value system. Because our value system, the value system that was imparted to us was not necessarily always the same as our religious values.
Yes. Can you think of an instance in your childhood that would remind you of that?
Not particular instances, but just the number of times that I saw my mother act like a little Christ.
Example then.
Our house was marked for the hobos.
Mine too.
Generosity of spirit.
That you believe.
Okay, somebody else.
I think one of my most profound memories was running to school and falling, it was like kindergarten or something, and dropping my nickel for my milk and ripping my tights and being able to run home and have my mom clean me up and drive me back. And kids today don't have that.
Being there.
Yeah, it was just very profound to always know that she was there. Mm-hmm.
I cringe for my two granddaughters that are, well, actually all four of the grandchildren, the two older brothers too, but they're 8 and 9 and a half, and they are home alone. I mean, their mother's at work by 6, and so is their dad, 6:30. They get up at 7 and walk, get ready for school. They didn't have a cell phone at one time. They have to give it up now, you know. And wow,
it's painful for us, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
I think mine would be my mother. My parents are both teachers. We're both teachers, but my mother, when we came along, my mother laid out for almost 15 years, so she was always home until my youngest sister was back in school before she went back into the classroom. Mm-hmm. So all those years, we always had somebody at home. Mm-hmm. We came home to mother. Mother was there when we left. So I think that was probably, I look back on it, a very positive influence. Mm-hmm. Because it was, you know, we never came home to an empty house until after we were all somewhat older. And then, again, we were in a small town down in the Central Valley of California, and within walking distance of school, so we could just, you know, walk over to school and walk home with the folks. Both my parents happened to be teaching in the same school.
Yeah.
So that was good.
What a network.
One of my fondest memories is a Thanksgiving dinner with many people there. I grew up in China in an isolated place that didn't have much family or friends around. And here is a whole bunch of family. And it meant so much.
Family tradition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it just started.
Yeah.
Just started. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I remember so much is, as a family, we'd all pack up on Saturday afternoons, and we lived in Baton Rouge, so we went to the LSU football game as a family. And, you know, then we'd meet up and we'd split up because we had seats everywhere. Then we'd come back together as a family and talk the whole way home of the game and the people we met, and it was just wonderful. And, I mean, I was 5 going to football games with my brothers and my parents, and it was just a wonderful communication.
And how many can afford to take their kids to a game
now?
It's
mind-blowing.
One of the things that it sounds like a very small thing, but I was born and raised on a farm, and my father and mother and myself and
dentist.
We used to go to the dentist all the time.
All together,
It was a boring experience.
And the four of us would, at milking time, we sang all the while we milked.
Oh, really?
And my youngest brother was too young to milk, and he sat on the bullpen gate, and he directed. The only problem, was when you get some of these songs, and I learned all kinds of songs, mostly my father's generation songs. Yeah. I can sing those. And the only problem was that sometimes we get into a song, we got too slow, and then he was afraid we'd never get done with the milking. So we had and we sang in the car.
Yeah.
All the time.
How many?
That's a rather small, but it certainly is a binding thing that I still remember to this day.
Did the cows give more milk as a result?
Yeah, right. Yes, they did.
Absolutely. That's always been a known fact. Well, I grew up in a small town. And it was a very, I was a third generation child in this town, and I think a lot of you can probably identify with this.
Oh, yeah.
But I knew if I did anything wrong, I was in trouble. Mm-hmm. And it didn't matter who it was that disciplined me, because they all felt very free to do so.
Yeah.
But I knew whatever I did was going to be around that community. It was going to be talked about in church the next morning when I was a teenager if I didn't shape up. And it was a very awesome kind of upgrowing. I don't think I...
I tried to carry on that tradition.
Yes, right.
My mother used to tell me, don't say anything bad about anybody in this town because you're probably related to them. Probably related to them.
Well,
I have a couple experiences to relate that identify a couple of principles. And the first one is, we had a motorhome when our kids were little, and we'd go off on voyages of discovery.
Oh, yeah.
And the first day, the kids were, restless and surly, and they missed their friends, they missed the telephone, they missed the TV, and these things. And after the first day, they sort of settle down to say, well, we know these things are not going to be around. And they'd start to be creative and work together and develop a family harmony. And the point of it is that there are very few times now in most families when you can exclude all these extraneous influences that tend to pull our family in individual directions rather than together. The other one is that when our youngest ones, the twins, became toilet trained, we decided to take a major excursion into the national parks. And I built a trailer, and everything was immaculately organized within this little trailer. And we pulled out of the driveway, and the axle broke. And we just got one of those covered U-Haul trailers and threw everything in, helter skelter. Well, the two of us have never worked so hard in our lives on this trip. It rained every night except one, and that night it snowed. We saw magnificent sights. The weather was okay in the daytime, it was just at supper time. We tried to make supper out of rain. But we always had a tradition that when we start home, that each child was required to write down what they liked best about the trip, to evaluate the trip. Mm-hmm. And I always had a tradition of when the kids got ready for bed, I'd tell them a story. And we had the same story has been going for 35 years now. And I have no idea what I'm going to say when we start. But the point was that out of all these magnificent sights that we saw, each child wrote down what they liked best were Dad's stories. And I think the point is that the incredible value of the interpersonal relationships between the parents and the child, and that is the key thing We went to a whole weekend seminar with Margaret Mead one time, and the whole point of her discussion was family traditions, and she developed a real burning desire in us to achieve that. She had some incredible data about the value of cohesiveness in families and the value in the upbringing and family values of the children, where you had good, strong family traditions as opposed to when everything was helter-skelter and you ate at KFC and so on. So we adhered to that, and even with my pediatric practice drawing on me and the erratic schedules that would produce, we always sat down to dinner together. And if one of the kids didn't come home on time, we sat there and waited for him.
And made him feel guilty.
And the, you talk about peer pressure. Anyway, any other comments about this sort of thing?
How about memories of the generation ahead of us? Memories of our grandparents.
Well, in our family, of course, that was one of the things very strong. And our grandparents and I was told many times, I knew very clearly that my mother had a grandfather who was a Lutheran pastor, and she had a granduncle who was a Lutheran pastor, and she had a brother who was a Lutheran pastor.
Did you feel a little pre-programmed?
The great thing was that my uncle, whom I knew, Uncle George, our pastor was a good man, but he just didn't have much sense of humor, I didn't think. If Uncle George had a good sense of humor, that was one thing that allowed me to consider the ministry. You could be a pastor and have a good sense of humor. But yes, I think that your background was extremely important.
Mm-hmm. One thing I'd like to add on to Phil's motorhome story was the fact that last summer, we now are doing the same thing with our older grandchildren. And we took four older grandchildren for 2 weeks on a motorhome trip. I want you to be prepared for the new generation, those of you who are grandparents. I got asked some questions I was definitely not prepared for, and I would be happy to talk to you about it in private. But it was very, very interesting, and these are children who do not write. They do well in school, but the first day was chaos, and the fact that they don't read has always just driven me nuts, because I've always been a reader, and I love to read, and I couldn't figure out why none of these kids love to read. So I had bought books, you know, I was prepared, and off we went. Well, the first day was, you know, a little nutsy, but by the end of those 2 weeks, each of the kids had read four books. We had reading time aloud, and it was the same thing all over again as with our children. And it was the greatest time, especially the day they turned to Grandpa and said, "Oh, Grandpa, mellow out. We don't have to be there right now." Okay, each of us is kind of at a different stage. There's a lot of folks in here who probably don't have parents living anymore. Is that a good guess? Yeah, we're now the senior generation. And that's sort of a sad thing. I look at Verling Smith, who has a 98-year-old mother still alive. I think, oh, you lucky guy. Do you, George, have a mother still alive?
I do, too.
You guys are lucky.
80s, yeah.
Yeah, mine died way too young.
You know, I'm 62 now, and I know women or people 50 and so that have no parents anymore. And it just blows me away that so many people, so much younger than me, have already lost their parents.
But our last, what we call our ancient, died a couple years ago, and that was my aunt. And that was really the end. And we all kind of, the cousins turned away from one another and said, "Oh, now we're the senior generation." And that was awesome. Mm-hmm. But, and some of you have children. Do any of you still have children at home? No children at home, so we're without that. Some are singles? Is that okay? And so you have a different kind of network that you're dealing with. But how do we stay in touch with these various people that are in our lives? And for those of you who are single, I bet there's nieces and nephews that you're close to?
Godchildren.
Godchildren, okay. You find a family, no matter where you are. You find a family. And let me tell you, those aunts and uncles and those godparents are, you are critical, folks. You really are. And the impact that you have on those children is more profound oftentimes than a lot of others. And all the rest of us who are aunts and uncles, that's oftentimes where the influence comes from. And it's so good if kids can have more than just their parents as adult people to turn to. And those who are grandparents, we'll come to that in a minute because you're the most important people in the world. But how can we relate to our family members who aren't far away? If we're, how many of you live in the same town with your family?
Which family?
Your close family.
Part of them.
Okay. Your children?
Our son lives on
Oakland. Oh, is that right?
My grandchildren.
I have two grandchildren.
Oh,
you are lucky. How about you folks? You too. You live in the same town as family?
No, we don't live in the same town. Yes, I live, all my nieces and nephews are
in the same
surrounding me.
Great.
4 children, 9 grandchildren within 7 miles.
Unbelievable. That is really unbelievable.
Well, it's a farm family, and 3 of the homes are on the farm. So
Right, I'm talking to you about that. Yeah, that's the kind of family I grew up in. I had to go 20 feet to get to my grandparents' house when I didn't like my parents anymore. And I did it often. But this is, how do we keep in touch? I think one of the things we talked about was email.
Yeah.
You know? Email. Okay, what are some other ways? What are some other things that we do?
We just had a family reunion. My parents turned 80, and all of the, for their birthday party, they invited all their kids. I mean, it paid all of our ways from all over the country and Mexico and stuff. And it was great. And it was like one of the things you said earlier made me think, like, who's going to carry on the traditions? And we sort of looked at each other and said, okay, who's going to be the family historian? Well, you do it, you're the librarian, you know. And it's sort of like, okay, well, you know. And then since then, we've had some email to each other.
So picking up and carrying on the roles. Yeah.
We have, you know, in my family, my father is still alive and is almost 90. I have a 92-year-old aunt and a 98-year-old uncle. But many years ago, we started, they started what we call the Clan Clarion. It's a published newsletter to which all family members, all the way down, we're now down to the fourth generation, contribute articles, write them.
We do this once a year.
And we just come down once a year. Now, my generation, my cousins and I, have taken it over, and we rotate the editorship around to various cousins. For instance, this year I'm responsible for collecting all of that. I have a cousin who works at the University of Nevada, Reno, in the printing office, and she has access to the printing machines. Her boss has given her permission to use these to publish the letter. So she, it's a very professional looking publication. Like, yeah. There's pictures and all that. The early ones were just typed when I was typed up. But that's kind of the way we keep in touch, and we're encouraging the younger, like I say, the fourth generation on, and even to contribute letters, and some of them are just, you know, little grade school kids, but they write their little letters, and they get published. So that's kind of fun. And that way we all keep in touch with, you know, families. Who's who. And
right.
She always includes the family tree in the newsletter and shows all the new marriages and additions and births and so forth. So you can keep track of, even if you don't know them intimately, you know who's coming along. And it kind of preserves the traditions of the family, because a lot of these, you pick a theme. One year we did a cookbook, other times we've done, you know, events. Pick a theme for the letter and you all write in on something like that. So that has worked very well.
How many of you keep in touch when there's, when things aren't so great?
We do, yeah.
Okay. Are you there when the family needs you? Because not families aren't always, you know, families are people, and things happen. Like, are there? How many? I bet most of you have a divorce, at least one divorce in your family. I mean, it happens now. I have a good friend who was my mother, care of me when I was a little girl, and now she's my friend. And she had three daughters whom I took care of. I mean, and then her daughter took care of my children. I mean, this kind of goes on in this funny little community. But her second daughter divorced, and that was the hardest thing in the entire world for her, because there had never been a divorce in their family until this was about 15 years ago. And it happens, and it's painful, and there's lots of painful events that do happen in families, so that's a really important time for us to keep together.
Ruth had an aunt who never married, and they finally had a divorce in this family, and she said, oh, she said, oh, we have a divorce, the next thing you know, we'll have a jailbird in our family.
This was about 50 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, I used to think, she said, I used to believe, think I could walk downtown and hold my head up, but now I don't.
It was big, I'll tell you.
You know, one of the other things we don't have on here, probably go with emails, how many of you telephone?
Oh, yeah.
Fax? We even do letter writing. Snail mail.
Write letters.
Twice
a year. Wow.
Christmas card.
Well, if your kids are in the morning, that's what you do.
Okay. Well, I'm sure we'll come up with some more things here, and we're going to come back to this, too, but Phil's going to talk a little bit about grandparenting, and those of you who aren't there yet, you'll get there.
The recent article on grandparenting indicated some roles for grandparents that just listed, and it's kind of fun to see what, one of the roles is being a living ancestor, sort of keeping track of family historian, which you eloquently told about your newsletter, role model, confidant, and crony.
We like the crony.
We like the crony. Yeah. And this, of course, is sort of in reference to Timothy, 2 Timothy, which we had up here, where he talks about the value system being passed on from one generation to the other. Now, we'd like to list some ways we can help to strengthen our family. And we've listed eight or nine of them here, and then we'll open it up and have you barrage us with extra things to tell us about. Support marriage contracts within the family. Give historical perspective. Provide unconditional love for the person and realistic advice for their actions. This is easier for a non-parent. Hugs and kisses, physical contact is so important for human beings. And I think we can look back a couple nights ago when John Schomburg told about his pastoring of a condemned murderer and the case history of that individual that never had any love. Totally bereft of love. And the personality that developed from that, that created the climate for him to murder. He had no self-esteem. Provide a safe economic environment for children while giving good values regarding money. And you had a quote on that, didn't you, Lola?
Well, chapter 4 in the book has a very good, it's a very good description and a very good discussion of this subject on economic stability for family.
In a rising economy, it's very difficult for parents to inculcate good economic principles in their children. It's a breeze in a depression. Mm-hmm. And I think probably all of us who were raised in depression had much different money values than our own children. And this is one of the most difficult things in parenting for us, that our kids developed sort of a champagne appetite, on
peer budget. If you don't have it, you become more frugal.
Yeah, that's
true. I think the epitome was when one of our kids quit his job and didn't have another one lined up. I mean, that to me, it was, the epitome of of waywardness.
Yes.
It's faith. It's just faith.
Remember how important oral, written and oral contact with older family members, especially those who live at a distance, and parenting. And I'm old enough to remember when the word parent was only a noun.
Yeah.
And the Christian service would be more compelling to do a superb job nurturing children, preparing them for true success in life. Each person has to balance their time and energy in what's hoped to be the ideal components. Work, family, community, church, all the yeses and nos that we talked about earlier in this book here. And I can look back in our family and remember when times there were opportunities that I didn't take because of constraints in other areas in my practice and other projects and so on, where I didn't give as much time as I should have. I diluted the time for my children. And looking back on it now, I would budget my time considerably different than I did. Some people jeopardize their marriage because of time and efforts are expended in other directions. And regardless of how laudable some of these other efforts were, we can think of situations where people were so involved in the work of the church, they deprived their own families. And I didn't expect to hear that, but I guess. But that is a problem with pastors. It's a problem with a lot of professions. And time. What were you going to say something about time?
Right. And that particular problem has definitely not gone away. We live in Seattle, as you folks do, and the Microsoft people are expected to put in 14 hours minimum per day, and they do. And so, fortunately, most of them don't have children. They're young professionals. They make their mark, and at 45, they retire as millionaires, which is wonderful.
Our third son is a restaurant manager, and he has to work 18 hours a day.
It's a ridiculous life.
24-hour a day operation, 7 days a week. He gets one day off.
How many of you remember that?
Yes.
Can you see it? Charlie Chaplin. What was the movie called? Modern Times. It's good to look at again. But there's a couple resources, and I think this one is still in print. In many ways, even though a lot of us are not active in the working world, we can be a good model or a good person to suggest to our kids or say, you know, have you thought about maybe another way to do this? Getting control of your life and time, regardless of what your age is, gives you that time to do the things that you'd enjoy or the things that aren't important. You can forget it. And along with that is this book. And this book is available in the bookstore. And this is one that I really think I'm probably going to give each of my children. But there was one of my daughter-in-laws got very intrigued. It's Voluntary Simplicity. It's simplifying your life. How many of you have heard of the Tightwad Gazette? Came out of Vermont, I think, wasn't it? Remember, it's out of New England. And this was a woman who was kind of like the 60s, when it was kind of back to the earth and making things live simple. It's kind of really the Holden thesis. But this book, and also there's a chapter, this book is referred to in our theme book, and both of them have good workups on simpler living. And the area that George and Hildegard live in and we live in, this is very much a factor, living lightly on the land. And so it all ties together, but sometimes we have to stop, and maybe your kids don't have time to think about how to do this, but maybe you can help them with just a suggestion. We've always composted in our family. My kids don't compost. They don't recycle. I'm going nuts about this. So I think we're going to have to be really mean here again. But it's called Toward a Way of Life That Is Outwardly Simple, Inwardly Rich. And I would highly recommend both of those things. Okay, let's get back to our circles up here. What are some ways that we can either do or help or be an example to maybe change any of the negatives that we've got up here? What can we do in our communities? Because this is not, anything that happens out here is going to affect us and going to affect our children and our grandchildren. And even though there have been a tremendous number of murders in the schools, that is nothing compared to the amount of child abuse and murders that's going on in the homes. Those children are interacting with our children. And we're going to talk about community on Monday, and I know a lot of you aren't going to be here. But community is integral to the family. And what kind of influences and what kinds of helps or changes can we make in this? Go ahead.
I'm not sure that this would, that we could do something, but maybe as grandparents. I was at a women's meeting a couple years ago, and this one lady had, I think, three children. The couple had three children. And their family time was such that, you know, and the kids and all these things going on. They worked it out in their family whereby if Johnny was in Little League this year, then things centered around Johnny at that time. And Susie and Philip, whoever, they went to Johnny's games and, you know, everything centered with him at that particular time. And then at a different time of the year, if it was Sally's turn, then that's what went on.
Uh-huh.
And so that the family meals and the family coming and going and the planning was around that particular child's activities.
So did they sit down, do you think, at a certain time and say, okay, what are you children going to be involved in this year?
Right.
It's kind of like a school year.
Yeah, and they limited it.
Yeah.
But she said it was working.
Not a bad idea.
It sounded real interesting, really, because so many times they're going this way, that way.
Yeah, instead of everybody doing everything all the time.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
The other thing, I've got the floor right now,
yeah,
in education,
yeah.
One of the things in education we get, you know, as former educators, I mean, we just felt pretty beaten down in the last few years, and we were talking about what we remember. Support from our parents for education was at the top of our list. If we were in trouble at school,
we were in trouble at home.
Mm-hmm. Whereas, it was a top priority.
Mm-hmm.
And the teacher was supported.
How do we do this with this? It's one of our toughest ones. As a community, how many of us address this?
Say what it is.
Oh, I'm sorry. Single parent. Chuck. Single parent homes. This thing drives me nuts. Single parent homes and education. Are there things in our communities, as a lot of us who are retired, we have more discretionary time at this point in our lives than we've ever had, unless we fill it up with things like coming to Holden all the time. But can we make a difference here in helping? Is there things that we can do to make these two things and this one different? Safety, children, yeah.
Even if we're not in the same community where our children or grandchildren live, you can hook into your education system and be a mentor within the public
in your
schools,
own, right.
Right? Wherever in your own community, the school closest to you is begging for people to come. And reading was one of them. And my grandchildren's school, yeah, just listening to children read out loud in the hallway, one on one.
Yeah. So even if it's not your grandchild, it's somebody else's. Right.
They need that.
Right. Okay, safety. What can we do about that? That came home to me the first time I was walking in a mall with one of my daughter-in-laws. And, you know, I used to take my kids to the mall and say, meet you here in an hour.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, where's Charlie? Where's Charlie? And I thought, why are you so worried? And then I realized this is the way she has to live.
In places like Disney, you know, the theme parks and Disney World and everything, that's where the pedophiles hang out too.
So what do we do about safety? What can we as members of the community do?
Work for gun control for one.
Examine factors, maybe one of the things we can do is be cognizant of what's going on in our communities. And if there's a need to change something, make sure it happens. But this is a big one. What can we do about this one?
I don't know. I just think that underlying clause here is just kind of shoved under the rug or something. It seems like the, a lot of these problems are, like he pointed out, people are deprived of love or something. And it all goes to the cohesiveness of the family. And it, all these here just kind of point out that it's everything's kind of separating more and more so.
But that has been the case in the past. This is not a brand new thing. The thing is, how do we address it?
Seems like the family's the core and everything else. Everything else is just a community type of a thing, but it's all...
When we have
back to the core, the problem is the family, and it's not the gun control anymore. I mean, you're treating the symptom, not the cause.
If we have this kind of situation with the family moving, families moving from place to place, if we have extended family living all over the country, then maybe we have to plug into other people's families and help there too. Maybe that is our family, our church family.
How many have heard of Lutheran Brotherhood's Search Institute, funding of Search Institute, Healthy Communities, Healthy Families? The whole state of Colorado, we heard this morning from someone, is buying into that program. And we've been introduced to it, you know, in our Grand Canyon Synod in Arizona.
Now, is it coming through the churches?
No, it's a Search Institute, a separate entity.
Okay.
It's funded by Lutheran Brotherhood.
It's coming in a lot of different directions. Yeah. It's coming through school districts. It's coming through
police
communities.
Police departments.
PTA.
Is that
Bert
Strummond's?
Really?
Search? Yeah, okay.
The Search Institute, Healthy Communities,
yeah.
Healthy Families.
They come
asset
in?
Asset building. They
right.
talk about building assets, that you need 40 or 42 assets to really make a well-rounded human being. Things that make a human human. And that our kids, in a group of seniors where we were asked the question, you know, how many had this, had this, had this, you know, in our background, those love, in a way, showing love. We all were scoring, you know, from 28 to 42 or whatever. And when you ask a random group of kids today, they're, you know, coming up with 8 or 10 or 12 assets.
The questions are like, how many adults other than your parents knew you by name?
See, and this is what it is. And how many, you know, would smile at you and look at you in the eye and speak to you, a stranger, you know. And one of our teachers, you know, was saying she really made a point in her own school to really, you know, make eye contact, which is again with the gang thing and everything, you know, that as a teacher though, with students, to call them by name once she was introduced to it, you know, in the context of her job, even though she didn't know or she would take time out.
Regardless of whether you live in an apartment building or in a community, how many of you know the children in your area by name? And call them by name. Let's make an effort to do more of that. This is interesting about the Search Institute. The Search Institute, a lot of that came out of Holden Village way early on. And we worked with Mert Strumman during the 60s. That's the book that we wrote because of Mert. And so a lot of what happened, he's gone on. He was a Lutheran minister who then went on and got his PhD in psychology. And they came into one of the most affluent communities in our Seattle area, to Mercer Island, which is where we used to live, and did the search program for the schools. And the results have really been interesting to the community. But it's good basic values is what we're talking about.
The time is up. We can turn off the recording now, but we'll stay and talk as long as you want.
Also, we really wanted to feel, or we felt like we should hand out something. So we have something to hand. We have a handout. And what this is a little borrowing from hither and thither. And the top one is called Sending Your Love. And it's mainly was written to those of us who have older people in our acquaintances. The second one is Writing Letters of Faith, and it's from Herb Brokering, and any of you who know Herb Brokering know it's always got a little heart in it. But that one is more to your children and grandchildren, and then a section on sharing and building memories. So I'll put these back on the table by Susan, and please take one if you would like one.
All those statistics you read, do you have any copies of
of that? I don't, but I probably, if I can figure out how to run the copy machine, could do that. It's Seattle Times. It's actually based on Census Bureau, and I'd be happy to. New York City Department of Consumer Affairs Research. We could make a copy of it.
Okay, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sort of discouraging. Isn't it? Keep in touch with everybody that you can. And you know, one of the best things is those women who love being moms and love having little babies. Every nursery I know needs a rocker. The rock babies.
You know, we never talk about discipline. Our kids lived in a family where none of our children knew of another family that did what we did, and that was have work assignments for all the kids on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, and then three or four times a year, a family work party. And of course, we weren't terribly popular with the work parties, but each of our kids has come up to me as adults and thanked me for doing it. They said, you know, we learned how to work. None of our friends knew how to work when they, you know, got out of school. They lost jobs and they, you know, and we felt very comfortable about working hard. So, and I think that it brings the family together. Lola's a creative one. She came up with the most creative lottery system, picking jobs and so on.
But one of the best things about getting to our age, and I'm sure a lot of you have experienced this, is having your children say, oh, wow, how did you do it? I love it. I never loved an age so much in my life as I love the one I'm in now. Thank you all for being here. For those of you.
Thank you.